interviews, reviews, and previews, all shared responsibly.
Not objectively.
Well, depends on the need.
Okay. Go walk your dogs.
And clean up after them.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Halloween Community Rally and the Spirit of Unity on Saturday, October 31st at Waterfront Park in Portland. In the Spirit of Unity will be a family-friendly rally to raise the minimum wage, defend workers' rights, demand renters' rights, and support immigrants' rights. There will be trick-or-treating, costume contests, games, prizes, and music by Portland hip-hop artists. Again, that's In the Spirit of Unity, a Halloween community rally on Saturday, October 31st from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Waterfront Park, just south of the Hawthorne Bridge in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is a good old song called I Wish I Was a Mole in the Ground. Sometimes you ain't what you think you want to be, but dadgummit, be satisfied, because you ain't what you don't want to be, and if you ain't what you don't want to be, you don't want to be something you ain't. That's good English for you, boy. This boy got it so bad, he said he wished he was a mole in the ground. He got it bad. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. Lord, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. If I wish I was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. I wish I was a baby in mama's arm. By the baby in mama's arm, could nobody do me no harm. Lord, I wish I was a baby in mama's arm.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The time is 9:01. I'm Joe Clement, your host and engineer for today. The Old Mole is a KBOO project that's been around since the late 80s. Its broadly socialist and feminist mission is to interrogate, investigate, and interpret history, culture, politics, and current events with a view towards human liberation and ending environmental exploitation. Naturally, the mole is a creature metaphorically close to and usually literally underneath the ground. In that sense, the old mole stays close to the perspective and struggles of everyday people and burrows beneath the surface of ideological appearances of everyday life. Our interviews, reviews, commentary, music, and humor are a collective labor that you can become a part of by emailing us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. On today's show, we start off with Bill Resnick and Herman Rosenthal talking about the recent Canadian elections and the bucking of decades of conservative rule. Clayton Morgeridge reads a commentary on open borders in Europe and draws lessons for the U.S. Fran Michel brings us a well-read read about Campus Equity Week and the adjunctification of higher education. And to wrap up the show, we hear a talk by Marxist economist Richard Wolff about what class is from the Marxist perspective and why it matters for us today. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. You can find an archive of the show by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour in the next day or two when we post the show. You can find links to mentioned material and to anything else that we find interesting. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter to get updates about upcoming or recently posted shows, and you can email us at Old Mole Variety Hour to get on our mailing list or to ask us questions and leave us comments. Now, though, we turn to Bill Resnick and Herman Rosenthal to talk about the recent Canadian elections. Bill?
Hi. Herman Rosenfeld, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for the correction.
Herman Rosenfeld is a Toronto-based writer, teacher, activist, involved in labor and transit struggles and efforts to build socialist political organization. He implanted an industrial work in 1976 was a militant working for the General Motors plant and their van plant in Scarborough, Ontario. He later worked for the Canadian Auto Union in research and worker education. More recently, he's taught at York University, also McMaster University, and written on Canadian politics for various publications. Last week, Herman was watching with some pleasure the defeat of Canada's arch-conservative party in last week's Canadian election. Herman, tell us about the election, and then we can get into why so much anger in the Canadian electorate and among working people at the Conservatives, and whether that anger can be mobilized to rebuild Canada's radical class forces and challenge corporate and finance economic control, indeed control of near everything. Herman Rosenfeld, tell us about, give us a rundown of Canadian politics and what happened last week.
Okay, Bill, thanks. It was a mixed evening, but mostly a relief, because the ruling Conservatives, which they've had for the last 4 years, have had a parliamentary majority, which in a parliamentary system, unlike the division of powers in the U.S., gives them lots of power. And previous to that, for the previous 6 years, they've ruled in various minority governments, which meant that they had relative amounts of power. And they're sort of like the Republicans, except not as goofy. Getting rid of them was wonderful, because they had a platform of a lot of similar neoliberal changes that you see in the United States. It was pretty it was an attack on democratic rights. They limited electoral rights. They were racist in some of their appeals. They were virulent in pushing for free trade, attacks upon labor rights, getting rid of the post office, yes, things of that kind. Anyway, the outcome was that they were turfed out. Out of a total of 338 seats in the federal parliament, the Liberals, which are sort of like a mix of what the Democratic Party is in the center, to the sort of the right, had 184 candidates elected. They turfed out Stephen Harper, who was sort of the leader of the Conservatives. They came in second with 99 seats, and they have certain regional and geographic bases. And the third party, which is a Social Democratic Party, which would be sort of like the center to the left in the end in the Democratic Party, maybe further to the left in other areas. They got 44 seats, and the regional party called the Bloc Québécois got 10. And the Green Party, which is relatively new, had one person reelected. The Liberals won 40% of the vote, the Conservatives 31%, and the NDP 19%. Now, the interesting thing to talk about, the Liberals came from way behind, where they were sort of a rump third party at their last election, although historically they have been one of the main favorite party of the Canadian capitalist class during the 20th century and the early parts of 2000s. Whereas the NDP has always been a third party, and in the last election in 2011, they became the opposition, and where they had a lot more votes, they had almost 5 million votes, and they dropped to about 3.5 million this time, and they dropped from their total seat. The total seats went down to 44. They were over around 103 last time. So it was a big defeat for them, although they had some people elected. Two-thirds of Canadians essentially voted against the Conservatives, and the fact that the two opposition parties didn't cancel each other out, and you have enough votes to get rid of the Conservatives, was a pretty decent response. The idea that the Social Democrats lost so much, it had a lot to do with who they were, and I don't know if you want me to talk about that now, but they basically have been moving more and more to the center, like most social democratic parties around. But the closer they saw themselves as getting to power, the more they watered down some of their criticisms of the system and some of the reform agenda. Just one in particular, which you might find interesting, your listeners might find interesting, is that the Liberals, when they were in power in the late 90s, they started the process of pushing along the austerity, and cuts to government spending, which had resulted in a previous crisis of the dating from the 1970s, and they did a lot of those cuts that started this process. And they crafted themselves this time. Their leader was a young son of the previous Prime Minister, Pierre Trudeau, who most of your listeners probably have heard of. He tweaked the nose of Nixon and a number of American leaders in the past, which endeared him to a lot of folks I know south of the border. But his son, Justin, basically argued that they were going to increase moderately, but he called it massively, but moderate increase in spending for infrastructure for cities and transportation, housing, a series of things that people have been complaining about.
Including going into debt to do it. It really was, they sort of adopted a fairly, it's a Keynesianism. And a job-creating mechanism that's sort of gone out of favor, even with the more left parties. It was interesting that was his major plank. And
yes, in fact, Bill, that I think it's a really important point. I'm very glad you made that. He actually said we're going to go into debt. And the previous government, the conservative government, passed one of those boutique laws, which are so disgusting, saying that you can't balanced budget laws, as Mitch meant, you can't borrow over a particular period of time, go into debt, which of course it could be overturned, but it's a symbolic statement which endears itself to all these Republicans in the United States, unfortunately a lot of Democrats as well, and he said he would abolish that and in fact go into debt in order to be able to create jobs and also to fix some of the infrastructure. And the interesting point is that the NDP, the Social Democratic Party, differentiated themselves and said they would keep the balanced budget amendment and would not go into debt. And we're very, very careful to say that we will keep a balanced budget, which astounded a lot of people and sort of depressed others and basically made them seem a lot more conservative than even the liberals, even considering the liberals' history.
It does seem to me that Trudeau's, the younger Trudeau, who was very different from his father, apparently. The father's a patrician, right, and saw Nixon as just a bungling boob. But Trudeau himself has an interesting background. He's actually done normal work in his life, even though he was a rich kid.
A high school teacher. He did into sports. And part of this is also part of his persona. We'll find out more in terms of what they do.
But the Liberal Party decided with the to in fact move towards sort of a Keynesian economic policy, which makes a huge amount of sense nowadays. I mean, the austerity regime around the world is collapsing in on itself. It's undermining the economy of any country that it's actually practiced in. Seems to me that's a sort of a ray of hope, actually, and they're sort of supporting public services, and antagonism to public workers and public services was always a hallmark. Then, I mean, trying to pit public workers against the greater number of people employed in whatever private firms of one kind or another, or their own little business.
The conservatives were very good at that. They made that one of their hallmarks in terms of their attack on. There's an attempt to increase public pensions. They didn't want to do that. And one of the provinces, wanted to have its own public pension plan to supplement the very miserly public pension program, which is less than Social Security, actually. And he attacked this as a tax on people's incomes. So there's a long history of that. But I think it's really important. The two points: one is the thing that you implied, which is very important, is that there's a sympathy for that point of view. The sympathy for the point of view which argued for borrowing and spending more on the public programs again. And that's one of the things that this election reflected positively. On the other hand, we'll have to see. Just the history of the Liberals is very mixed around these things. As I said, historically, they were the ones in the post-war period, post-World War II period, which implemented a lot of the social programs, which were championed by the socialist left and the NDP and the labor movement. But they also were at the forefront of cutting them. So we'll have to see just how much they push this. But the fact that it's out there, the fact that people voted for it, is very, very important, and it's critical. And I think it's part of one of the reasons why the NDP itself lost so much support. Although there's some crude electoral components to this, there's also this refusal to actually inspire people for that they're fighting for something different.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Herman Rosenfeld, who is a former auto worker, became a researcher, writer, teacher. Now he writes for lots of publications in the United States and Canada on class struggle in Canada at a very low level for too many years under conservative governments of one kind or another. It seems to me there's a possibility for, certainly it's always possible, but there's a possibility of using this election and going forward and actually building trying to rebuild the left. Why don't we first talk, though, about the deep roots of the rejection of the conservatives? We talked about some of the impulses, working class impulses in the majority of the people to use government to support the economy and support ordinary workers and take economic measures that actually are pro-growth, which is another problem, and that the environmental crisis can only be solved by moderating growth and changing it in many ways. But that's a question. It's a question we face now. We probably are going to have to. But what are the deep roots of this rejection of the conservatives, and particularly the insecurity of working people now?
Well, there's deep and there's not deep roots. There are certain elements. This rejection isn't as deep as I we would all hope, because it is a necessary rejection of globalization, neoliberalism, or globalization, or the kind of driving force, the dependence upon the success of big corporation and finances to be able to pay for social programs. It's not a rejection of that, because nobody's really floating that as an option. On the other hand, there is a lot of frustration and anger that people have over a number of issues, and I think this is what you're referring to, this is very important in terms of the fact that public pensions are so small, the fact that the environment that Canada has played such a terrible role around climate change, with the tar sands and the dependence upon export of fossil fuels, that there's a movement to challenge that. That public health care, which has such tremendous support here, that has been defunded, the fact that a lot of things have been privatized, a whole series of things that could mobilize people if there's some good organization around it in terms of mass movements and that sort of. There hasn't been that much, although it's like in the U.S. and elsewhere, things break out where you don't expect them. Like there was a wonderful movement called Idle No More of First Nations people here. We had Occupy as well. There have been different movements around public transit in different cities. And the movements around minimum wage and living wage also are very, very important. They involve labor, but they also involve younger people, people organized around poverty, but also working people that are not organized.
Yeah.
There are a series of places where things could break out and need to happen.
Even as there's so much discontent and a tremendous amount of insecurity in the population and yearning for a different economic policy, there's also tremendous fear about agile mobile capital or footloose industry or the holders of economic power and wealth, and who can so easily abandon Canada and move to lower wage places like the United States and even then much, much lower wage places. It seems to me that people are poised, they're extremely angry about what's happening to them in their lives, and even worse, their worries about their children who cannot find decent jobs, even with PhDs. It seems to me those
are very well, they're very well-made points, and the points is people are ambivalent. On the one hand, they see what's changed, and they don't like it. It's scary. On the other hand, if you really think that there is no alternative, that there can't be an alternative, that you really can't stop foot. People always say that you can't stop because the foot was kept. We just supported, they just bargained this another free trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and each time it enhances the capacity of capital to move. And nobody is saying we need to organize to stop the ability of capital to move, that we need to be able to stop all of those things which make us insecure, and that it's possible to do so. So one of the things that people do is that they hunker down and they say, well, I'm going to do my best for my kids, and I'm going to try and ask for things or look for things that won't antagonize employers. There are things that are mixed in terms of and that's one of the reasons why you had people voting for the conservatives before, and also you have right-wing populists, which often people who package themselves as apolitical, they're just looking for the people who get support. And this happens, it pops out all around the developed capitalist world, and Canada's no exception. But you need to be able to find some ways of building some kind of experience and confidence that it's possible to challenge these things, and that it's possible to build movements which have that kind of anti-capitalist orientation. Like, people are not stupid. People in workplaces, people who have to have three jobs in order to survive, people in different elements of the working class, they know where they're dependent. And part of building some confidence is giving the sense that we can break that dependence or limit that dependence through building movements.
Yeah. This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here talking to Herman Rosenfeld, a Canadian writer and labor activist, teacher. Herman, give us a few ideas. How do you see the immediate to midterm future working out, not just in Canada, but all over, actually, now the world, where people are in the same position, completely dependent on the goose that doesn't lay golden eggs anymore, but that's where the eggs come from, and passive and intimidated. How do we build that sense of alternative, both of power from below and of a different kind of economy that's also sustainable? And not dependent on constant exponential growth. Give us a few ideas.
I think that there are movements. They're small and they're scattered, and we need to help to build those movements. And also, with those of us who believe that you really can't fight the environmental fight without challenging private ownership of the means of production at the same time, and building collective capacity to organize our economy differently, and to argue for the people, the workers who are in those sectors, to be able to find decent alternative employment, then you have to work in those in those movements to do that. There's a very interesting movement called the Leap Manifesto of sort of left social democrats in Canada, who issued a statement around the tar sands and building the environmental movement. There's a movement around public pensions, about deepening public pensions. Yeah. The question of defending the public sector.
Herman, I'm afraid we only have about another 10 to 15 seconds.
All of those things are critical. You have to work in, I'm working in public transit, but socialists have to work in those movements to develop a socialist orientation with other people, and also we need to build political movements which challenge the system, which don't speak crazy language to people,
Herman,
which actually speak the language of ordinary working
people. Herman Rosenfeld, thanks so much. We'll talk again.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you very much.
Right. So long.
Bye.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We are now going to turn it over to Clayton Morgridge, who is going to be reading us a commentary on open borders. The idea of open borders is looked at in particular in Europe, but the case is brought to bear on the United States, and the suggestion is that we should get rid of borders everywhere.
A few days ago, Teresa Hayter published an article on the Jacobin magazine website
Why We Need Open Borders. Hayter is an author and activist in the United Kingdom and the author of Open Borders, The Case Against Immigration Controls. The Jacobin article is worth reading in its entirety for its summary of the historical causes of migration from the south to the north going back to the 16th century. As young Asians in West London say, we are here because you were there. I'm going to read from the second part of the article in which Hayter lays out the argument for abolishing border controls. She's writing about the migration from the Middle East to Europe that's so much in the news these days, but we might apply these arguments as well to our own borders. If Western governments desired to reduce the number of people trying to find safety in Europe and the suffering that results from such attempts, they would refrain from invading other countries, from impoverishing their peoples, from providing arms to repressive regimes that collaborate with the West, from requiring neoliberal policies of austerity that create inequality and poverty, and from destroying the world by their consumption of fossil fuels. They could also abolish immigration controls, for they can be explained only by racism. Governments maintain that they must be tough on immigrants to defuse nativist racism. But in reality, the controls feed racism. They legitimate the arguments of the racists, making it appear that the only way to win votes is by appeasing racist sentiments. But the new and massive support for refugees in Europe shows this is not the case. Many have an exaggerated and false view, fed by both politicians and the tabloids, of the number of immigrants, of their criminality, of their effect on jobs and wages. Abolishing controls and acknowledging that they lead to suffering among fellow human beings would be one good way of countering racism and encouraging a politics of solidarity in its place. Ending controls would no doubt lead to some increases in migration. There might also continue to be surges in the number of refugees and a continuing need for far greater levels of compassion than currently exist. But abolition would not mean millions would move to Europe or North America. Few people choose to leave their families and communities for an uncertain future. Migrants come because there are jobs. Refugees come because they are desperate to flee war, oppression, and poverty. Many would return if they were free to come and go, but they are trapped. In Britain, with the immigration controls of 1962, and in the U.S., as the Mexican border is made increasingly hard to cross, migrants must settle permanently and bring their families. Abolishing controls should not be an economic decision, but the reality is that refugees and migrants add to a country's prosperity and public finances. Most research, including the government's own, has shown that immigration leads to increased employment and higher wages. Any threat migrants may pose to the wages and jobs of natives is based on the precariousness created by immigration controls and the threat of deportation.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Sorry about that. At air, we were hearing a bit from Clayton Morgridge reading about open borders. Up next, we are going to hear Fran Michelle bring us a well-read reg, which will consist of a couple of different readings about Campus Equity Week and the adjunctification of higher education, which has meant the proletarianization of professors.
Good morning and best wishes on Campus Equity Week. This is a week dedicated to addressing one particular inequity among the many inequities of life in the neoliberal age, the increasing turn toward part-time and temporary positions among university teaching faculty. I draw here chiefly on two essays, one by Mole favorite Yasmin Nair, titled Class Shock, Affect, Mobility, and the Adjunct Crisis, and published on contrivers.org, and the other by Nancy Welch from International Socialist Review, titled Educating for Austerity, Social Reproduction in the Corporate University. Both of these are worth reading in their entirety, and you can find links to them posted on my KBOO blog. As Welch notes, quote, while 75% of U.S. college and university faculty at the start of the 1970s had the security of long-term tenure-track employment, today more than 75% of instructional faculty are classified contingent, teaching on contracts as short as a single semester, typically without health care, disability, or retirement benefits. Half of these precariously employed professors are classified part-time and paid a per-course median rate of $2,700. Dubbed freeway flyers, they must frequently speed from one campus to the next, and still they fall short of a living wage. Yet hard times have not come to all on college campuses. Administrators in U.S. colleges and universities now, by some counts, outnumber faculty and reward themselves with salaries worthy of Wall Street. By 2013, 9 public university presidents were drawing more than $1 million in annual compensation. Skyrocketing, too, are public universities' net assets. Public and private universities alike foreground in their mission statements the business-like goals of efficiency and external investment opportunities. These rags or riches tales also represent the reversal of fortune that neoliberalism, the employer's offensive of the past 40 years that has smashed unions, slashed wages, and eliminated health care and retirement provisions, has brought to all employment sectors in the United States. Far from existing as an island apart, the university is subjected to that transformation described by Harry Braverman at the start of the employer's offensive, the transformation of all society into a gigantic marketplace. Welch notes that while cuts in funding have rationalized cuts to programs in subjects like women's studies, Africana studies, German, music performance, public history, and linguistics, spending has actually increased at universities, paid for not by public spending, but by exploited faculty and debt-ridden students. Between 1978 and 2012, U.S. college students have borne a total tuition and fee increase of 1,120%. Meanwhile, the government has been increasing its surveillance of academia with demands for assessment and accountability. While programs in women's studies or American ethnic studies are still available at elite universities, on other campuses there is more angling to deliver core curriculum on the cheap through online courses or through so-called competency-based education. These changes are part of bringing universities back in line with the needs of a differentiated capitalist economy, sorting and ordering the workforce. The Ivies are charged with elite formation. Other privates and a handful of public Ivies with credentialing a professional middle class, and the many state university regional campuses, state colleges, and community colleges with training skilled workers. Preparing workers for an increasingly precarious labor market means providing those workers not only with the knowledge appropriate to the work they may do, but also the dispositions to accept the exploitative system in which they find themselves. This education in disentitlement is delivered through both curricular content and the disaffecting experience of enrolling in high-priced, supersized, or online classes. But an education in service to austerity is delivered foremost through escalating debt that trains a generation of students to accept the notion that education should properly be an up-to-the-individual expense. As Yasmin Nair points out, many recent narratives about adjuncts rely on what she calls class shock, juxtaposing, for example, the advanced degrees and other accomplishments of contingent faculty with their reliance on public assistance and food banks. A PBS report puts feelings of entitlement and shame bluntly when it quotes a professor fighting on behalf of adjuncts saying, "Adjuncts are the lowest paid people on campus. They get paid less than the folks who come in at night to clean the classrooms." This last statement is, of course, meant to be a damning indictment of the betrayal of the adjunct, saying, in effect, we pay highly educated people with multiple degrees less than the uneducated slobs who clean up our trash. The press has highlighted the apparently shocking fact that a great many highly educated adjuncts are on food stamps, but so is a full 15% of the U.S. population. In the U.S., everyone pretends there is no such thing as class, but everyone's biggest nightmare is facing a descent into a lower class category. For years, academia has meant a form of class mobility for many, but the rise in adjunct positions and the slashing of tenure lines, along with the increased contempt for the professorial class, has meant, in effect, a dwindling of the possibility of entrance into a class position and consequently a wider sense of class shock. If we ignore the class narratives at play in all of this, Nyer continues, we run the risk of only making incremental gains for a select few. There is no returning to those real or imagined halcyon days when white male professors in tweed jackets peacefully toiled at their desks, unencumbered by questions about their next meal. There is indeed much about that scenario that needs drastic revision. At the same time, substituting women and or people of color in that scenario in some neoliberal version of diversity will do us no good. Rather than insist that we need and want more places in a system that will reward the deserving with a privileged class position, we might want to argue simply that we deserve the rights of all workers, that intellectual production is labor, that teaching is labor. The reality, of course, is that adjuncts are not simply after class status, but very real benefits, including life-saving benefits like health care. But in the U.S., such benefits are part and parcel of class status. Employment itself is seen only as a product of hard work, with no attention to the systemic inequalities produced by capitalism. And consequently, benefits are seen as accruing to those who deserve them because of their greater devotion, their work ethic, and so on. The perception of failure to achieve class status as a failure reinforces the link between material benefits and class status, instead of what should be a logical outcome of any real understanding of inequality, that everyone deserves benefits, regardless of class status. As Welch points out, the movement to abolish tenure altogether in the University of Wisconsin system is the latest logical development in capitalism's built-in drive to commodify all labor. To convert, as Marx wrote more than 150 years ago, the physician, the lawyer, the priest, the poet, the scientist, into its paid wage laborers, and prepare the way for de-skilling and proletarianization. As Welch stresses, reproducing capitalist social relations and ensuring a desired quantity and quality of labor power are not schooling's only possible functions. Workers historically have fought for education benefiting the development of their human capacities rather than restricting them to serving as instruments of profit. The successful demonstrations in South Africa this past week against increases in university tuition are only the most recent indication that mass struggle can beat back the corporate offensive. Such movement is most successful when it forges alliances among students and faculty, workers and community. As Welch stresses, protracted intersectional struggle is the only antidote to the market subordination of all society. In South Africa, in Wisconsin, in Chile, and Canada, and Oregon, each strike and struggle throws up the immediate, urgent questions. Who will have the rights to education, health care, retirement, and a life unburdened by debt? Each strike and struggle also throws up the biggest question of all. What kind of social order will our schools serve? For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
When I was younger, I lived in fear that incarceration of some kind is near. I checked my head, intact with rules. I nearly became a goddamn fool. But I've heard voices, not in the head, out in the air. They called ahead.
respectable. This is my mission throughout the whole flight duration. There is a core, and it's hardcore. All is hardcore when made with love. The love is voice of savage soul. The savage love is indestructible.
Listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host. That was me playing banjo there. Sorry about the mix-up earlier. We had a technical issue where we just lost the file we were playing from when Clayton Morgridge was reading about open borders. But be sure to go to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour in the next day or two when we have the recovered file posted for you to listen to in its entirety, with actually, I understand, an extra couple minutes. Well, up next to wrap up the show, we're going to hear from Marxist economist Richard Wolff about what class is from a Marxist perspective and why it matters for us today.
The way class works in our society can best be understood if you think about how a business works. In most businesses, the people who do the work come 5 days a week, use their brains and muscles doing what the employer sets them as tasks with the equipment and materials the employer provides. At the end of the day, they go home, and the employer keeps the fruits of their labor, which the employer then sells. And the goal of the employer is to get more money when he sells the output than it cost him to buy the tools, equipment, raw material, and hire those workers. Class is this difference between those who do the work, the overwhelming majority, and those who gather the profit into their hands. The way our society splits up the output leaves those who get the profits in the position of deciding and figuring out what to do with them. We all live with the results of what a really tiny minority in our society decide to do with the profits everybody produces. The profits in our society are huge. When you think about 500 to 1,000 large corporations in the United States do the overwhelming bulk of the business, you realize that into the boards of directors of these companies flows a huge part of what you might call the discretionary income in this society. If these profit-earning companies decide they can make more profit by adopting a technology which has the unfortunate result of polluting the air or the water, corporations will typically do that because the profit is more important to them than the social consequences that basically they don't have to live with and they don't have to pay for. And so you'll get decisions about how to use the profit, which is a social disaster in terms of the health, mental and physical, of other people. Having a small group driven by profit gathering into their hands the discretionary funds shapes everything about the way we live. Class is one of the most repressed discourses in this country. Many Americans insist that we're all in the middle class, that if there are a handful of desperately poor people at one end and maybe a handful of desperately rich ones at the other, they're really a tiny footnote to a vast middle. This is a way of pretending that class differences, wealth, power, corporate structure, somehow aren't there or don't matter. They pretend that the issue isn't there or it doesn't matter or we all have it under control, none of which are true. The overwhelming majority of people have to go to work 5 days a week who live from the income that their work provides. And a very small minority have enough wealth to live off the wealth. The richest 10 or 20% of our country, which owns half the wealth, that's why they're the richest. They get rent on their land, they get interest on their money, they get all of these rewards, whether or not they do an ounce of labor ever. Whereas the vast mass of people can only live by their labor. This is a fundamental inequality that infuses everything about our culture. The lip service as a nation we give to equality, to democracy, to equal opportunity are radically undone by the reality of the class structure. So class is going to force you into unpleasant recognitions and confrontations with a reality that has to be changed. Foreclosure in the United States today is, in fact, a perfect example. Over the last 30 years, we have faced a phenomenon we never had before in the history of the United States. We have had rising real wages in America, roughly from the beginning of our history up until the 1970s. If you worked hard, you got more money in your wage envelope at the end of the week. It was true for 150 years, and that's really amazing, and no other country did that. It stopped in the 1970s. Because of computers replacing people, because of American companies moving abroad where they could pay lower wages, because of a mass movement of women into the labor force, immigration, and we went from a country with a chronic labor shortage to a country with a chronic labor oversupply. Employers no longer had to raise wages to keep workers working, to keep them happy, to keep them employed. And as a result, the American working people went into a kind of prolonged psychic shock. Their wages weren't rising anymore. And so what they did was they turned to another source of money to realize the American dream that they had been culturally developed to hope for, to expect, to promise to their kids. They borrowed money like crazy. And the business community of the United States saw in the borrowing of the American working class a fantastic market to go after. You know, in the 1970s, at the beginning, the only people who had a credit card were wealthy people or folks on business expense accounts. Starting in the 1970s, we gave credit to the mass of Americans. Everybody gets a credit card, and everybody can go to the bank to borrow to buy a home. Mortgage debt, credit card debt explodes. It was a money-making extravaganza. We saw all the wealthy come together to get involved in this money, building houses, lending workers at huge interest rates the money with which to buy the new and expensively built homes. Wealthy people poured their money in to companies that built these homes, furnished these homes, decorated these homes, and you have a literal explosion of profitability. But of course, you can't keep lending to working people if their underlying economic situation isn't improving. So it was only a matter of time until the extra borrowing reached the limit of the underlying frozen, stagnant wages. That was hit in 2007. Millions of Americans could no longer afford the houses that they had borrowed to buy. And the foreclosure crisis represents the rage and anger of the wealthy class. If the underlying people they lent money to can't pay for them, they're going to take those houses back, throw those people out of their homes, and try to find another way to make money. Here's a perfect example of the profit motive creating a housing boom that becomes a bust, and that now, to recoup the money of the minority who invested in it, requires millions of people, the majority, to literally lose their homes, producing in the United States in 2010 and 2011 a society that has millions of empty homes side by side with millions of homeless people. Enormous pressure was placed on the United States government by big businesses, the businesses that produce homes, that clear land, that produce construction equipment, the businesses that produce the furniture that goes into the home. All of those companies have put enormous pressure on the government for the last 100 years to subsidize, to stimulate everything having to do with the home construction business. They asked the government to subsidize mortgages, which we've been doing in America since the 1930s. They wanted the government to help individuals buy homes because their well-being as corporations depended on selling those homes, selling the furniture, selling the equipment that dug the ground for the homes, etc. So the whole corporate structure of the United States has been geared to making money by developing the private home business in the United States. They are the ones who have made the major difference in all of this. Every house virtually bought and sold in the United States over the last 25 years, with very few exceptions, was paid for with a mortgage loan. That is, the buyer of the home goes to typically a bank and borrows the money with which to buy the house, and then has to make a long-term repayment to the bank for having borrowed that money. As a loan, it has two sides, the borrower and the lender. In our kind of capitalist economy, it is the rule that a banker has the social responsibility of properly assessing risk. If billions upon billions of dollars were lent to people who couldn't pay it back, then the culpability is at least as much on the side of the bankers who made those loans as it is on the borrowers who took them out. Borrowing vast amounts of money to buy homes took off in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. It had not happened before. So if you're going to blame the victim, you have to explain why the victim undertook these blameworthy activities just then and not, for example, in the previous 150 years. And now the most important point, which I made earlier. Starting in the 1970s, the American working class stopped getting real wage increases. So we have a desperate working class that undertook that borrowing because they had to. Because even though they became more and more productive for their employers did not raise their wages for the last 30 years. That's why they borrowed money, and that's why they borrowed too much money. And had the employers not taken advantage of the market to stop raising wages, had they simply continued to raise wages as American employers had been doing for the 150 years before the 1970s, there would not have been this explosion of borrowing, and there would not be the foreclosure crisis now. So the blame for all of this is really not to be found with the individual borrower, or for that matter, even with the individual banker. We have a system that worked in such a way as to drive the masses of people to borrow what they shouldn't, and to drive the corporate sector to invest and lend in ways they shouldn't. The fault is in a system that makes people behave in ways they all come to regret. Capitalism here worked better than it did in other countries for a long time, and it accumulated a lot of wealth. Over the last 30 years, it hasn't raised the wages the way it had for 150 years before. The confrontation with the inability of capitalism to deliver the goods was postponed by having Americans work way more hours than other people in other countries, and by having American workers take on a level of debt no working class ever anywhere had ever seen before. But we've now run out. We can't do more physical hours of work, and we can't borrow any more money because we're unable to pay what we've already borrowed. And we're now going to have to face it. And I think what we're going to see is an American working class that is now going to rediscover class and realize that they have to question a system that works this way. They're going to demand fundamental changes, and when they do, and as they do, they will rediscover the language of class, relearn it from the working people in other countries who never forgot it, and it'll re-enter the discourse and debates of American society, and probably with a vengeance.
Well, that's all the time for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been your host and engineer, Joe Clement. I want to give thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest, Herman Rosenfeld, for their discussion about Canadian politics in light of the recent election and the ousting of the Conservative government. Thanks also to Clayton Morgeridge and Fran Michelle for their respective commentaries and well-read reads. Clayton talked about open borders in a segment that got cut a little short, but you can listen to the entire segment online in a day or two at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. There you'll also be able to catch Fran Michelle's well-read read about campus equity and the adjunctification of higher education, and will provide a link to Richard Wolff's talk that we just heard about class. Stay tuned next week for more news, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Radical Perspective. Up next, we're going to hear Air Cascadia with cutting-edge news, views, and interviews with Chris Andre. At 6:15, Locus Focus and host Barbara Bernstein will be interviewing guest Jimmy Tobias of Nation Magazine. We'll talk about how the grouse fight is about more than a bird. It's about fossil fuel and warped logic of extraction at all costs. At 11, it's Disability Awareness. Today's guest, Rebecca Miller, Planning and Development Specialist with Multnomah County Aging, Disability and Veteran Services Division. And at 11:30, we'll hear Voices for the Animals with hosts Courtney Scott and their guest Sandy Miller of the Free Oregon Zoo Elephants, talking about why and how elephants suffer in captivity.
Beirut Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Imperialism, Climate Crisis, and Struggle, an evening with Harsha Walia and Luz Rivera on Sunday, November 8th at 5 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Harsha and Luz will speak about their work and experiences cultivating fierce, loving, and sustainable communities of resistance within a transnational analysis of capitalism, settler colonialism, state building, and racialized empire, and how climate change threatens to or is already compounding the forces of state and corporate violence against which they struggle. Again, that's Imperialism, Climate Crisis, and Struggle, an evening with Harsha Walia and Luz Rivera on Sunday, November 8th at 5 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.